Today marks 18 years of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, and this morning I'd like to share some reflections about that. I speak as a citizen, as a father, as a veteran, and as a clergyman, and my plea is to end this war in Afghanistan, at least end the U.S. involvement. Many of us remember that fateful day when the towers fell, the Pentagon burned, thousands died. Some remember 3 days later, Congress passed the authorization for the use of military force, empowering the president to use lethal force in Afghanistan. I remember 10 days later, my son was born. September 21st, a day the United Nations calls the International Day of Peace. As I held my son in my arms for the first time, I remember the hope in that moment, the hope that he would be a peacemaker, he would grow up in a peace-loving nation, he would live in an era of peace. But when my son was 3 weeks old, 17 years ago today, the United States invaded Afghanistan. Soon after my son's first birthday, the U.S. Congress passed a second authorization, empowering the president to wage preventive war in Iraq. Soon, the bodies were coming home in caskets. When my son was six, he held my hand at the graveside service of Mark Palmateer, a soldier from our town, killed in Afghanistan, laid to rest right up the road from this congregation. The troops were overextended. Soldiers were killing themselves in record numbers. I wanted to do my part. I didn't want to kill anyone. So I volunteered to serve as a military chaplain. When my son was 10, he watched his father put on army fatigues, pack his bags, and get on a plane to Afghanistan. I said goodbye to my five children and my wife at Stewart Airport, just down the road. I looked into my children's eyes as they wondered if their father would ever return to them. And I left this congregation. While deployed, I provided religious support at more than a dozen dignified transfer ceremonies of U.S. service members killed in action or who killed themselves in action. I saw blood pour from the bodies of soldiers. I gave pints of my own blood to keep the wounded from bleeding out. And here at home, I delivered the knock at midnight to some unsuspecting household as part of a casualty notification team. I held mothers and spouses in my arms as they sobbed and screamed. I have witnessed some of the high costs of these U.S. wars. Now my son is 17. It's a sad irony that although he was born on the International Day of Peace, in his lifetime, he has known only a United States at war. What began in Afghanistan and spread to Iraq is currently a global war on a never-ending battlefield. Currently, the U.S. has military personnel deployed and equipped for combat in at least 19 countries. The stretch of our militarized and weaponized drones is global in reach. Last month, we got a letter from the high school informing us of the No Child Left Behind Act that requires public schools to provide names and contact information of their seniors to military recruiters. The letter informed us that we had a choice and that if my son so desired, he could sign a waiver and refuse release of his name. My family and our religious community values public service. We value military service. My father volunteered to go to Vietnam. I volunteered to go to Afghanistan. We have a sense of civic duty. We are patriots. But I was proud of my son when he refused to have his name released to the military recruiters. Perhaps he learned something from my example. After 5 years as an Army chaplain, I resigned my commission in protest, to protest the U.S. policies that have trapped the United States in Afghanistan in a cycle of endless war on a global battlefield. Our religious community covenants to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, the interdependent web of existence, the goal of world community. This covenant is at the core of our religious faith. It applies to all people, everywhere. Grounded in this covenant, in this faith, our religious community has spoken up, following the wisdom of Martin Luther King Jr., who spoke from the pulpit at Riverside, "There comes a time when silence is betrayal." Our religious community has spoken up to repudiate aggressive and preventive wars, the disproportionate use of force, like the mother of all bombs dropped in Afghanistan, the relentless air slaughter from airstrikes, targeting that includes high risk to civilians. Our religious community has spoken up to repudiate unilateral intervention and extended military occupations as dangerous new forms of imperialism. For 17 years, the U.S. has been killing people in Afghanistan. The U.S. has dropped thousands of bombs, perhaps tens of thousands of bombs, on the people of Afghanistan. The U.S. has killed thousands of people, perhaps tens of thousands. The United States flag, the flag that I wore on my shoulder when I went to Afghanistan, bleeds red with the blood of the innocent. Let me speak for a moment as a veteran. I can't speak for all veterans, but I can speak for many who share these sentiments. We veterans took an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, both foreign and domestic. Implicit in this oath is an oath to protect our families, our neighbors, our country. Over the last 17 years, we have watched as the White House has misused the military. The White House has betrayed us. The White House has inflicted us with moral injury. Moral injury defined as a betrayal of what is right by legitimate authority. This moral injury is one of the primary reasons so many of our veterans kill themselves. We look back at these 17 years and ask, what have we done? Who have we become? We feel resentful. We feel disgusted. We feel guilty. We feel ashamed. Our moral injury is evidence not of disorder or sickness, but of moral sensitivity and moral seriousness, the kind of sensitivity and seriousness many of our veterans find lacking in the larger society that they risked all to serve. Out of our moral pain, we find motivation, a moral revolution. On Tuesday, I was in Washington, D.C., with veterans and concerned non-veterans to demand an end to the U.S. war in Afghanistan. We delivered a petition to the president, signed by over 20,000 citizens. The stand that we took on Tuesday is a stand of patriots. And as we stood there at Lafayette Park and demanded an end to the U.S. war, I held the flag of the United States. In our repudiation, in our demands, we remain forever hopeful, boldly imagining a different kind of United States, where we choose to fast and not fight. We choose to bridge and not bomb. We choose to care and not kill. And it is to that United States that I pledge my allegiance. a nation that we imagine can love peace and is dedicated to a world beyond war. On my drive up this morning from Pennsylvania, I was listening to a book by Rosa Brooks, a legal scholar. It's called How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. In that book, Professor Brooks, who teaches at Georgetown International Law, says this, speaking to her fellow citizens, "We should ask ourselves this, do we want to live in a world in which every state considers itself to have a legal right to kill people in other states secretly and with no public disclosure or due process, based upon its own unilateral assertions of national security prerogatives?" It's a complicated question. It demands of us moral sensitivity and moral seriousness. My answer to that question is unequivocally no. I do not wish to live in such a nation or such a world, nor do I wish that upon my children. On Tuesday, before I stood at Lafayette Park at the White House, I visited the Russell Senate office building. My first stop was room 248. It's my new senator, Toomey, of Pennsylvania. My second stop, room 393, Senator Casey, my other new senator. My mission to get acquainted, but also to speak a shorter version of my message to you this morning. From there, I walked over to the Longworth office building and visited the office of my new representative, Dwight Evans, congressman for my district. In all three offices, I introduced myself as a citizen, a veteran, and a clergyman. I filled out comment cards, met with their legislative assistants, and spoke my truth to the power of the United States government. As I walked through the halls of the Russell Senate building, the Longworth office building, and then walked from there to the White House, I felt as though my feet were praying. And I feel embarrassed to confess this morning it was my first time ever to step foot in either one of those buildings. And I asked myself, why has it taken me 46 years to step into this building? It felt good and it felt right. But there was some sadness in my heart, sadness that I was there as a person, as an individual, and I had to wonder, can I speak on behalf of this community? Can I carry a message to your elected officials as your minister? What would that message be? I don't know. Can this community speak with one voice on the issues that I've addressed this morning and larger issues? Can we move beyond hanging flags on the building to speak a message to people that might be able to change the society in which we live? I hope so. I hope that our ministry can be a shared one. I imagine going to Washington every month with a bundle of letters from you and visiting the offices of your senators, not mine because my residency is now Pennsylvania. In some ways, we can expand our impact if we collaborate. I may have moved my family to Philadelphia, and I may be geographically further from you, but I'm closer to Washington, and it's just a short train ride away. How would you like me to serve you as your minister? How can I amplify the voice of this congregation beyond a hilltop in Orange County to the halls of the Russell Senate building and the Longworth office building, to the State Department, the Pentagon, and the White House itself?